What up, listener? We wanted to take a second to thank you for listening to this Blue Wire podcast. Be sure to show your support to this pod by subscribing and dropping a 5-star review on iTunes, a follow on Spotify, or the appropriate dApp for any other platform you might be listening on. And if you're enjoying this show, chances are you'll like one of our 75 other sports podcasts. Find more shows you'll love at BlueWirePods.com. Thanks again for listening, and now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
It's Chris-a-mania, brother.
That's a great question. Look at you, man, with the powerful questions.
Woo!
This is the Chris Van Vliet Show.
Chris Van Vliet Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Van Vliet!
Well, hello again, my friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Chris Van Vliet Show. And thank you so much for making this a top 10 wrestling podcast in the world. And if you've been watching my interviews, you'll know that a year ago I had Mickie James on the show. Actually, it was exactly a year ago because it was at last year's Royal Rumble in Phoenix. She said, you know who you should interview, Chris? You should interview my husband. And I said, yeah, like 100%. So I've been in contact with Nick Aldis since then. So a year ago, trying to line things up, and it wasn't until this past weekend at NWA's Hard Time pay-per-view, I made the 8-hour drive to Atlanta to do this interview with him, which is awesome, and 6 other interviews. So 7 interviews in total. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out on any of those. But I don't need to tell you that. I know you're already subscribed because you're listening, right? Thank you for subscribing. Also, take a screenshot. Tag me, tag Nick. Let us know what you think of this interview. Let us know what stands out for you. And so many of you have been leaving these 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for that. I've said it before, but I'll say it again. It's the most important thing and the most helpful thing you can do to help the growth of the show. The specific goal for this year is 1,000 reviews. We're at 630 right now, and it's not even the end of January yet. So I think we're doing okay. DDrum77 says, CLE loves the CVV. I love Cleveland. So thank you. Great job on asking the real questions. This is the podcast to listen to. CVV is the real deal. Well, DDrum77, thanks for leaving that review on Apple Podcasts. And I love Cleveland. Miss it. I got to get back there soon. I spent 5 years in Cleveland, but I've only been back once for like 2 days. So Cleveland, I'm coming for you soon. And yes, I'm still a Cleveland Browns fan. It's painful. But yeah, still a Cleveland Browns fan. So NWA has something very special going on. If you've been watching Power, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't watched an episode yet, you're totally missing out. Although you wouldn't be listening to this interview with Nick Aldis if you haven't been watching Power. I think the two go hand in hand. They have this amazing combination of nostalgia and present-day wrestling mashed together. Nick Aldis is the world's heavyweight champion, or as he'll tell you, the real world's heavyweight champion. And he's had a really interesting journey to get here. You might know him as Magnus from TNA, where he was a world champion. But as he describes it in this interview, I think pretty well, he says he's both the most overrated and underrated guy. People always say, oh yeah, Nick Aldis, overrated. Or Nick Aldis, man, that guy is underrated. And I think he's exactly right. That is, unfortunately, how a lot of people feel about him. But NWA is just the perfect fit. And he's such a nice guy. I loved this conversation with him. And I know that you will too. Give it up for the national treasure, Nick Aldis. Well, thank you for bringing this with you.
Hey, no problem. I understand that that's part of the act. It's what people want to see.
But that, I mean, well, they want to see you as well.
Sure.
Yes, but sure. You've had this for so long.
Yeah.
That you guys are, you know, merged here.
Yeah, yeah. Just having this conversation with someone downstairs is just you reach that point where you're, you know, if. When part of your act is sort of you're known as being the world champion, you know, and it's like it's good, but it's also, you know, more pressure because then it's kind of like, all right, what about when you're not, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I always felt like that about Bret Hart. Like, he was my hero, and it's like, but, you know, even when he wasn't the champion, it was kind of like, you feel like, well, he's the champion. You know, yeah, right. That's how I always felt about Brett, you know.
Well, I think with this new era of NWA, like, you are synonymous with this championship.
Yeah. And that should be the goal, I feel like, of everyone in their promotion. They should want to be the franchise player of their promotion.
Yeah.
You know, because then it's like, you've done everything you can do now as an individual.
Yeah.
So now you're going to try to lift the rest of the business and the brand and everybody around you. And it's like, man, last night the pay-per-view we closed the show with the finals of the TV title tournament with Ricky Starks and Trevor Murdoch. And it's like those two guys who we knew because of the work that they've all done and everyone on the team has done and the way the audience responded to those two guys. We knew that final, they could carry it,
right.
You know, even after being out there two more times.
Yeah.
And that's it all started with this, you know, it all started here. Yeah. And that's a cool feeling. Very gratifying.
So Billy Corgan bought the NWA in 2017.
Yeah.
At what point did you start getting involved in conversations?
Quite early on. I mean, summer of 2017, I guess.
Oh, wow.
Was, yeah. Cause, Mickey and I were in the process of, house hunting or moving house. I forget one or the other, but I just remember we were in a hotel, because we were, looking for somewhere new to live and not like, but just for the weekend. We had sort of gone there just while we were, doing the last bit of stuff. And Dave called me Dave Lagana, and just kind of said, what's going on with you? You know, like, what are you doing? You know, because I mean, I'd just like fallen off the face of the earth in wrestling. You know, I'd just been like there, because everyone just assumed that I would go to WWE like after I finished up with TNA.
Yeah,
that didn't happen, and it was like I did some stuff with Jeff with, you know, Global Force and, you know, and like whatever, and that kind of fizzled out, and I was just, you know, bouncing around like on the independents. Me and Mickey both were, and it was like. Then she got the opportunity to go back, and she did the NXT match with Asuka, crushed it. Vince is like, bring her back full time, you know. Yeah. So then we kind of go, oh, well, that changes everything. You know, and Dave was, I think he was, you know, he was sort of in the same position as a lot of people where they were going like, what is he, are you, have you quit the business? What are you doing? You know, yeah. like why are you not in WWE, and what else are you doing? You know, like, what's the deal? And I just very candidly told him that for whatever reason, there seems to be some sort of problem with WWE. And, I just didn't really fit in anywhere else. Mm. You know, like there was this sort of new, like this new style had like taken such a hold on everything, like this, you know, celebrating this very sort of high impact, fast paced, you know, kind of high spot style.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but it was kind of like, you know, you could, that was where everybody was leaning that way. So of course nobody was really thinking, oh, let's have a guy like that. And so it was just one of those things, you know, you have hot and cold periods. And I just was, you know, I was cold, and I just went, I don't know. Like I just said, there's just nothing really, there's nothing's grabbing me.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing and if I don't have passion for it, like I can't commit, you know? And then he basically said, Billy bought the NWA. I said, yeah, I know. I remember seeing the headline and thinking, huh. The thing that most surprised me about it was the fact that I had kept sort of half an eye on all the drama with TNA with him, you know, with Impact. And like, all I could think of was, geez, like he's like just jumping right back in, you know, after all of that debacle and millions of dollars and, you know, and just sort of all the stress and everything. And I thought, now he's bought the NWA. And I just remember thinking, all right, I wonder what he's going to do with that. And I didn't really give it another thought. And then they've started explaining what their philosophy was and their vision for what they wanted to achieve, and explained Billy's vision for, you know, the things he missed in wrestling. Because I have to explain, when Billy came to Impact, literally his first day on the job was my last day.
Oh, wow.
So we kind of, you know, he said, hey, how are you doing? Introduced. He helped produce this one last thing I was in, and then it was kind of like, all right, bye.
Wow.
So it was like, so there's been this very, very brief sort of professional interaction. And, you know, it's, I described to Dave what I felt was missing in the industry, what I wanted to see more of in the industry, and the stuff that grabbed me as a fan. And I basically said, look, I'm a boxing fan, but I'm not a boxing aficionado. Mm. I love boxing, but I'm not going to, I'm not going to watch two jabrones fight for no reason. Like, I need to be invested, right? So it's like Canelo Triple G was that year. Like, you know, obviously Mayweather McGregor, and they'd just done a fabulous job. Like, they, you know, a once in a lifetime type of thing. And I go, what happened to the prize fight feel?
Yeah.
You know, like, what happened to the prize fight approach to promoting? You know, I was like, Vince McMahon's the greatest promoter of all time, but yeah. Now he's like an executive producer of this giant sort of Nickelodeon wrestling. You know what I mean? And that's nothing against them. Like, they're an incredible business model, but the promoter element has kind of gone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. There isn't that kind of, this is the match. Like, it's like there's another pay-per-view 2 weeks from now, you know, and it's too much. Like, everything's just kind of, it's a machine. And that's, and again, I can't say I would do anything differently because they're making money hand over fist.
Sure.
But it left, to me, a gap in the market for, okay, so they're kind of doing their thing of like McDonald's, you know what I mean? Like, they're going to be in every corner of the globe, and you're going to know what you're getting, you know what I mean? It's like, it's reliable, it's there, it's the brand. And then you've got like this, you know, New Japan and then, you know, the fledgling sort of promotions, and then there's Ring of Honor at the time. And they're kind of offering that hipster wrestling, you know, like that kind of like yeah. niche thing, right? Where it's kind of like the cool kid, you know, the cool kids wrestling. And I went, I think there's a bunch of people that miss like the classic, like irresistible force, immovable object. Here's yeah. the showdown. Who's going to win? Like, and who's going to be the world champion. And we just like, I got off the phone with Dave. And he goes, all right, well, let me talk to Billy and you know, blah, blah, blah. Billy called me 2 minutes later and was just like, just gushing about like Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher and like, oh, you know, I want a bunch of big raw bone men and I want like this and I want that and I want like this. I want to have this feeling. I want atmosphere and this. And I said, great, you're speaking my language. Let's, yeah. you know, we can absolutely do that. And between us all, we formed what eventually became the 10 Pounds of Gold series yeah. because it was like, well, what can we do now? We don't have a ring. We don't have a roster. We don't have a thing. We have a brand. We have like, you know, you bought this intellectual property.
Yeah.
And you have me, you know, and we have Tim Storm. And it was like, what a gem, you know, like we just, I remember Dave saying to me, current champion's this guy called Tim Storm. And he's like, you know, he ain't Ricky Steamboat, but just let me know what you know what I mean. He's like, just there's something about this guy, right?
Yeah.
And they show me this interview they did with Tim in the classroom because he's a teacher.
Yeah.
And I just went, like that, because the promoter in me, like that's how I look at everything, right? Like I look at an opponent. I don't look at somebody and think like, oh yeah, he's good. Like I immediately think like, can I make money with him? Mm. You know. Because that's how I was taught. Like that's like the guys that I sat under the learning tree of, like Kevin Nash and Sting and, you know, Mick Foley and Kurt, like they said, you know, just can you make money with someone?
Right.
You know, and I remember just looking and thinking immediately, I just went, the whole story is just right there. Like yeah. here's this honest to goodness, like, you know, Texas good old boy. He's a school teacher. He's like the most likable human you could ever meet. He's just, you know, but he's also a big, imposing, raw-boned man, you know, like a real red-blooded male.
Right.
And then you've got this guy in his early 30s. You know, he's had lots of opportunities. He's, you know, he's a lot in a lot of people's eyes is this sort of typical example of like, you know, the blue chipper pro wrestler. You know, like this. You know, like, and it's like. And I've got a little bit of a chip on my shoulder based on the sort of, you know, the trajectory of my career over the last couple of years. And he's just like, hey, man, this is my mountaintop. Like, this is the, you know, and it was just, And there's me basically declaring, like, I'm coming for that, you know, and it's this kind of like, oh, wait, no, don't take it from him, you know, and it just, it spawned everything because people just kind of went, you seen this? Like, we felt every day we would feel just a little bit more, just industry people and fans saying, yeah, man, that 10 pounds of gold thing is kind of, you know, that caught me off guard. It was interesting, yeah, you know, and it's... Yeah, I'm so proud of those. Like, you know, go back and this is interesting because I basically had a bunch of bookings, had a bunch of independent bookings, you know, set. So when we kind of said, okay, we sort of roughly laid out like what we were going to do. I just said, well, look, I've got all these bookings already in place because I'd started doing some stuff with Tommy Dreamer for House of Hardcore. And Tommy deserves some credit, actually, because right around the same time, he had the same conversation with me where he went like, why the hell is nobody tapping into you? Like, what a you know what I mean? He's kind of going like, what the hell? Like, why are you just sitting on the shelf, right? Like, and he was like, can you come and do some stuff at House of Hardcore? He's like, you know. And I went and found James, who did Marty's original villain vignettes, and I sat down with him and we did some interview stuff. I did some villain vignettes where I just candidly spoke about like I don't fit in anywhere, you know. And then I went and I said, you know, I've been underrated and overrated my entire career. It's the dumbest thing in wrestling, right? Like, literally every year of my career, there's a bunch of people that will say he's criminally underrated, and then there'll be someone, he's so overrated. You know, it's like, well, do you like him? You like him or don't like him? Right? That's it. But like I did this promo with James, and I went, fitting in is overrated, and it became like this little thing, and we were playing those vignettes on House of Hardcore, and it, like that coincided with the NWA stuff. So then like we sort of married the two, and that really just that was like the whole thing. And then I said, look, we've got an opportunity here organically to recreate the traveling champion thing, because I've got these bookings in Australia, I've got these bookings here, I've got the, you know, all over the country and in Europe. And so we were able to, within the space of 1 year, you know, defended the title on 4 different continents. And it was like, and by then it was, you could just feel everybody kind of going, that's cool, you know, like retro cool.
And were you getting booked, or was the championship getting booked?
Well, originally these were existing bookings, okay, right? So basically what happened was, the 10 pounds of gold series started coming out, you know, and after about 3 or 4 episodes, people started going like, hey, this is pretty cool. Like, and so then when I won the championship, they did the surprise thing at CZW and everything. All of these promoters that I was booked for, I had bookings through like the next sort of 5 or 6 months. And, they all within the space of like 48 hours, right. Hey, can we make this an NWA championship match now? Like, this is so cool. You know, like, hey, would Dave, you know, would he come and film? Like, you know, can we be part of like the 10 pounds of gold series and blah, blah, blah. So we started sort of making these deals with these. We're basically like, hey, you know, if you cover the expenses for Dave to come along and, you know, and we bootstrapped it. Like Dave and I have traveled all over the world together. Literally, you know, I wrestled in a building in Belfast that was like below freezing. You know, we like went, you know, to China, Australia, like all over the place. And he's been with me, like with his camera, you know, getting all this stuff and making these pieces and just, just in real time. And then, you know, obviously as time progressed, we caught the attention of Cody and we just used everything as like, okay, what can help the overall growth of the NWA and in turn me.
And I think that All In was a really big platform.
Oh, 100%.
You know, that was an incredible match with you and Cody, but that was a great platform for this championship.
Sure. It became the sort of the punctuation point of this, you know, that first year, because it was like to be able to look back and think by, you know, we literally started doing the 10 pounds of gold stuff around September of 17. And then September 18, it's like 10,000 bit. And if you can go back and find, I don't know which episode, but there's one of the very early ones where I said I'm visualizing defending this in a full arena, in a sold out building. You have to.
Yeah.
It's the only way to do it. You have to believe. And I'm not talking about like spiritual, you know, mumbo jumbo. I mean, like, you've got to have a 100% conviction and the courage enough to speak it and put it out there into the energy to say, I'm going to take this from you know, where it was to I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make this feel like the real world championship again. And you know, so to then get to Cody and I and, like, you know, that... No, you know, for fans, I understand that the finish is it was the moment, you know, for them. But for me, the opening bell was the moment. Yeah. That was my win.
Of us were all crying at the end.
Sure. Because at the, you know, at the beginning, Earl does the instructions, rings the bell, and the whole place just stands, you know, and just starts rumbling. And it's like, you can't force that. You can't, you know, create it. It just has to happen. And we, and it's like, that was the big win for me as the protagonist.
Yeah.
Antagonist, sorry.
Yes.
I'm the protagonist in the 10 pounds, most of the time in the 10 pounds of gold series, but in that was the antagonist.
You mentioned it earlier. Why didn't things work out with WWE?
I don't know. Hmm. I honestly, it's like,
your wife works there. It seems like it
would
make sense.
Yeah, that's almost like, that's almost kind of more of a problem.
Ah.
Like, because I'm looking at it then thinking, well, is this, you know, is this a favor, or is this, you know, or then it just becomes, oh well, that's just an extra, you know, complication we don't want to have to worry about. The reality is, Chris, that there's somebody there who is very, very successful, who, you know, for whatever reason decided that he didn't want to have anything to do with me, you know, because of some of his actions on a personal level. And I just, you know, it's one of those weird things. They can't, like, there's no way to address it. And I've had conversations with him over the years, and I honestly got to a point where I just went, I'm done chasing that dragon, you know, like, it's ultimately, what's my vision here? Is it to be in the WWE, or is it to be a big time pro wrestler? Because you don't, you know, there's one way obviously provides a much quicker path to the other, but it's not the only path.
Yeah. And that one person is probably not going anywhere in WWE. So you've created a much better thing here on your own.
Sure. And, you know, And what I realized was, if that's the case, and of course no one will confirm or deny, right? Like, everyone just, I don't know.
But we can all speculate, though.
Sure. But here's the thing: if that is the case, then what would happen if I did go? You know, like, it wouldn't make any difference even if I did go, because it would still be problematic. So it's just like, all right, cool. Like,
yeah,
I'll go over here and make a big deal. You know, make a big deal of something else.
When you were kind of in that limbo period before everything happened with NWA, what was the plan?
Like I said, I had started talking to James about, you know, doing some, because Marty was a bit inspiration, you know what I mean? Because for so many years, you know, he'd been sort of struggling and toiling and trying to get something to work for himself.
He's also the overrated, underrated guy.
Oh yeah, 100%. And then suddenly, you know, the villain hits, and it's like, and he's off to the races, and it's like Bullet Club, and, you know, and he's a hot property, right? And so there was, you know, there was some very, very early kind of talks with Ring of Honor and, like, different, you know, but it was like, I knew that I had to find, like, I needed a reinvention, you know what I mean? I needed to sort of reestablish shows, because everyone's memory of me was just this product of TNA.
Yeah.
You know, like, they had never really seen Nick Aldis. You know, they had seen...
They seen Magnus.
My entire TNA career is a struggle of me trying to do me, and whoever was in charge at the time trying to say, no, you're this guy, this is what you are, you know? And so I'd always find somewhere in the middle, and it didn't work, you know? And it's like, even was the world champion, it was just like... You know, and then, like, once I suddenly went, well, I can do what I want. Okay, cool. Like, you can shape the character.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I tell young guys now. Like, it's progressed just in the span of my career. It's progressed from you used to send a promo picture, you know, by email. Then it was like, then you had to send a promo picture and a link to a YouTube, you know, maybe a YouTube link or a video of a match.
Yeah.
Now you got to produce vignettes, you know, like if you're going to stand out, you know, if you're going to get booked and, you know, you're going to make an impression, like now you've got to like produce, you know, you've got to like be a producer and director, like Ricky Starks, perfect example. I happened to see somebody retweet, you know, like his 1-800 Starks line vignettes. And I just took one look and went, sent it straight to David Billy and went, I don't know anything about this guy, but I can make a pretty safe bet that if he's willing to invest that much in himself, he's good.
So you
know?
Were the guy that put Ricky Starks in there.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. Wow. So I came across the vignette on Twitter and went, that guy's money.
But this is the world we live in now. There's no gatekeepers anymore.
Mm-mm.
You know, we don't have to have a vignette produced by NWA or Impact or WWE. You can go out with your phone and some decent editing software and do what Ricky's doing.
Yeah. You know, we're independent contractors, which, you know, we can discuss the merits or drawbacks of that till the cows come home.
Yeah.
But the one thing you have to say is that you are an entrepreneur, right? And if you're an entrepreneur, you don't have to be good at everything. I'm not a good editor, but I am a good producer. I can see in my mind's eye what I want something to look and feel like, but I don't have the technical skills. Maybe, but I'll just find someone who does.
Right, and then double down on your strengths.
Sure,
which makes perfect sense.
Right, right, and it's just like, you know, just you need a team. You know, it's all of this, you know. The power, you know, the success we've had, it's a team. It's understanding, like, these are strengths, these are weaknesses, like, you know, this will set him off, this won't set him off, you know, and all this kind of thing. It's understanding personalities too, and it's navigating the whole thing. I always say that I think the reason why, for the most part, our booking or creative, whatever we want to call it, is consistent and solid is because there's like a three-headed monster here. There's Billy, who's very creative and very artistic with, you know, very sort of out of the box. I mean, look at his life and career. It's like, absolutely. You know, that's his world, right? And then there's Dave, who's very television oriented, very much on like new media, very, very on the pulse of like what certain things need to be covered in order to get eyeballs on it and get attention, and obviously his own writing and creative background. And he kind of leans a little bit more towards like shtick, you know, and slapstick kind of funny kind of stuff a little bit. And then there's me with the very serious like wrestling, you know, booking 101 and the very like prize fight approach, promoting sort of style. So those three influences sort of shape the overall variety of the show.
Does that mean you have a job, like a behind the scenes
job? Not officially.
Okay.
You know, like I'm not officially, you know, but I mean, we're a small team, you know, start, but obviously, considering the fact that the entire thing was sort of based off of a show about me, like obviously I'm kind of involved in the process,
right.
And then when it comes to this stuff, it's like, you know, it's just a discussion, and I'm not the only one, you know, but I'm obviously trusted because, you know, because of my position. I'm all in.
What parts of Magnus did you have to drop to become Nick Aldis?
I don't know really. I don't think it was a case of dropping stuff. I think it was a case of allowing the rest of my stuff in, because I felt like there was, and a lot of it, some of it's just experience too. It's just being green, but it was like learning to relax and everything. But I think, I don't know. I just think that for me to thrive and succeed, I needed to be authentic. Right, I needed to feel like it was me talking, right? Because I feel like my own personality is so sort of strong that it influences anything I would do. But I just always felt like, well, I'm not me. I'm playing a part. I'm playing someone else. Mm. You know what I mean? And it just didn't. And I think that you know, when you back and look at it, it's like, I see a guy who just is, you know, in black and white. You know, he's not fully in color yet. Okay. You know, he's trying to stay within all these boxes and parameters and stuff. And I just kind of went, well, I'll just do me. You know, like, let's just see what happens.
Right. What was it exactly that didn't work out the first time in TNA? Why did you leave?
Well, the reality is that, you know, when you get to that point in a business, in a company, that, you know, if you're a top talent, you have to have a good relationship with the office, with the boss.
Sure.
And my relationship with John Gaburik just unfortunately deteriorated. You know what I mean? It just was like, it was just an unfortunate set of circumstances. They decided to sort of take a punt, right, with me almost, at the same time that AJ was leaving and they couldn't get the deal done. And they, you know, and that was, at the time, just felt like a huge loss. You know, it felt like a real sort of spiritual part of the NWA had kind of been ripped away. I'm sorry, the NWA of TNA. And it then became, I became like the poster boy for this dark period, you know, like, and I could feel it instantly, but I wasn't mature enough to know how to deal with that.
Right.
So instead of kind of being like, all right, what should we do? Like, how do we do this? I just started kind of blaming everyone, and, you know, and so I take full ownership of the deterioration of the relationship, because I didn't know how, because I was put in this really difficult position with no experience of how to deal with that and no one to help. And I'll tell you the other thing. At the time, it was like, I just remember certain top talents. I just remember seeing for the first time, like, oh, here's what time it is. Because suddenly all these guys who, you know, 2 years ago or a year ago had been like helping me out with this and that, or giving it, suddenly they're all just kind of like, oh, hey, you know, like, oh, wow. You know, and then I would hear him around the corner, like, you know, and I'd think like, wow, here's what time it is, you know. And again, I don't have the patience, and yeah. I was too young and immature to know how to deal with that. I mean, I was 27, you know what I mean? I was too reactive. All the guys who were my friends in TNA at the time, they could vouch for this, but I was telling them when I was the champion there, like, I'm out of here when my contract's up, like, I'm done, like, I'm finished, I'm not.
As the champion.
I was the world champion, and wow. I was going, I'm out of here when my contract's up, you know, I'm done. I had like I basically had a no cut contract, you know, at the time. Like, I had basically that they could only terminate it if I breached contract. So I knew I was, you know what I mean? I knew I was safe, but like, once I saw, like, I was like, all that's going to happen here is, you know, it's just, my value is just going to continue to slip. So I was saying then, like, I'm out of here. Like, I'll just go figure something else out.
And unfortunately, that seems to be the story with a lot of people in Impact or TNA at that time. Just, yeah. I guess it's a management thing. I don't know.
You know, he came in and, you know, managed to get the position somehow. And then when he left, he just went right back to WWE. So what does that tell you? I don't know. Like, who knows, man? I just remember it was such a mess there by then. It would just become, the energy was all wrong. You know, it just become really toxic.
But that is the place that you met Mickey.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that's obviously,
that feels like a lifetime ago. You know, like that TNA. But that was the other thing about TNA. It was like every year it felt like a different place, because they would bring in, and because it was never, they wouldn't change. They would do is change who was like in charge of creative, or the sort of the next top person under Dixie, the owner. Right. It was always like, okay, now Bruce Pritchard's in charge. Now Eric Bischoff is in charge. Now John Gaburik is in charge. You know, whatever. And it's all the other people were the same,
right?
And it's like, that's the problem, guys. Like, it's the rest of it's like the guys who aren't pulling their weight, promoting the live events, and it's like this guy and that, you know. And it's just, it was a mixture of people who were just trying to get a payday versus and a bunch of lifers who were just like, yeah, it's an easy gig, like go along to get along, you know what I mean? Like, and then there's the talent going, ugh, like,
right,
we've got a live event with Jeff Hardy and Kurt Angle on it, why is there 300 people here?
I was such a huge, you know what I mean, TNA fan. No, I get it.
Like that roster.
Yeah.
The TNA roster in like 2012, 2013.
Oh my God. So Samoa Joe, Sting, Hulk Hogan,
AJ Styles, yeah. Like Kurt, like, you. Oh my God. Like you Bobby Roode, you can't turn your head without finding like a top level talent, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the moment when you and Mickey, obviously you met backstage, I'm guessing, but when was the moment where you went, she's pretty cool?
Not to, I don't want to get too personal and mushy here, but obviously I knew who she was and I'd seen her on TV and everything, and obviously identified, like, oh yeah, you know. But
yes, she's a very attractive woman, yes.
Sure, and but then when I saw her in person, it was just totally different, you know. I was sitting there and she walked past and I just kind of forgot what the hell I was doing, you know what I mean? And Doug Williams was sat with me and he was just like, put your tongue back in your mouth. and it just, fortunately, it was just one of those chemistry things, like, then, because then she kind of noticed me. And so this is a funny story. I had to go do some promo pictures at TNA, and the way it was set up then was like Lee South would do the photos, and he would be in the back end of the impact zone, so you'd have to walk through the impact zone to get to the thing. So I put my trunks on, but like pretty much just had like my trunks on and my like running shoes, because it was just going to be like waist up shots, right? So they're all in the, it's early in the day. So, and Mickey and Lisa were in the ring, like with Al Snow, kind of like going over some of their stuff. And I was walking around the ring, and I just, you know, Mickey's not subtle. Like, she's loud, you know? So, and she just, I just heard her. I get sort of to the point where she obviously thought I was out of earshot, and she goes, I'm a looking and I'm a lacking. And I just like stopped and turned, like, and I remember she obviously, then she was like, oh my God, you know. But then my favorite was just look at Al Snow, because Al was just like, you know, just like, oh my God. Well, we'll never hear the end of it now, you know. And so it was kind of like, after that, it was just kind of like, hey, so, you know.
I love that you bring your son with you. I saw you at the big event in New York.
Yeah.
And your son was with you there. He's with you here today.
Yeah.
Does he come with you all the time?
Not all the time, you know, but he comes to these tapings, you know, for now. He's come to every single one. And it was, you know, some of the guys were talking to me about it, and they said, it would almost feel weird if he wasn't here now, you know, like as soon as I got it, like everyone says, is Donovan here? You know, and I'm like, yeah, he's here. You know, you hear him before
he's
you see him.
He's a bigger star than you now.
100%. You know, story of my life. But like, I look at it as like, I people ask us all the time, obviously, oh, is he going to be get in the business? I'm like, who the hell knows? He's five, you know what I mean? But I just think of it as, I like him being around. First of all, he's happy. He likes it here. That's so that's important. The most important thing, right? Like, yeah. If he was miserable, like, I wouldn't drag him to this. I would just get the nanny. But he likes coming. They obviously the folks at GPB are phenomenal. They're such a great partner for us. And, you know, the company, again, given my sort of position, you know, they make some nice concessions for me. And one of them is that, you know, we have a nice little room set up for him. And, you know, because they understand that because of Mickey's, you know, Dave's worked for WWE, yeah. Right? So he understands that it's like, it ain't as easy to just drag him to that.
Is he he's not as welcome at WWE?
No, it's not, he's not welcome. I want to make that clear. He's been, and and like from what I've heard, like Stephanie's great with him, and you know, like he's been on this, he goes running down the ramp and he's on the set, you know, and all that stuff. But you know, it's not as easy to you can't do it all the time, right? Sure. Like it's okay. You know, it would be it would become a thing, right? So well, and just the travel, you know, it's like they're going all over the place. So with here it's like, but I like the idea of, for now, he's getting to be around this energy, because the energy here is great. You've been here for a day now, like you see it and you feel it. It's like the energy here is so positive and so like just it's just fostering this like this mentality of like, it can be done, like let's go out there and crush it.
Yeah.
And I mean 100% this is the most passion I've ever had for the business, and I'm 15 years in. So whether he decides he wants to be a wrestler one day or not, or whether he decides he wants to be a botanist, you know what I mean? It's like, I like the idea that he just gets to be around me at my most passionate and engaged, so that he can understand that's, you know, that's what being a professional is. Like that's sort of like, I'm a big believer that your environment really sort of helps you out in that regard for the rest of your life.
Which is why I would think that in 10 years, he'll start to be like, Dad, I want to do what you're doing.
Maybe.
Or you know, he could go the complete opposite way and be like,
well, yeah. Well, look, my father was a rugby player, but he was also a very well-regarded plant breeder, like plant breeding scientist.
That's why you said botanist.
Yeah, right.
So, it wasn't just a random profession.
Yeah, random. But like, I, you know, my dad used to take me to work with him because I used to love, like, oh, cool, like big, like combine harvesters and tractors and this and that. But he was like the boss, you know, he was sitting there, he was in an office most of the time, but he would go out in the field with the guys and, you know, cause he loved like, cause basically his specialty was barley breeding. So obviously there's a big, you know, very big commercial implications for that, you know, sure. so he'd be sought after. He'd have to go to Australia for, you know, and this and that to basically figure out like when to plant and like what, you know, what soil and all this kind of stuff. Right.
Yeah.
But I became a pro wrestler, you know, like, you know, it wasn't like, it's just whatever speaks to you, but obviously I felt like I was brought up in a good environment, you know, to sort of foster the idea that like, you know, approach things with professionalism and with you engage your brain and really think about it and get involved and get stuck in. And I, when I told my dad I wanted to be a wrestler, like my mom was like, what, no, please don't do that, you know, whatever. But my dad was just like, all right, do it, but just approach it like a professional.
Right. When you talk to your family back home, do they think you've lost your accent?
Yeah.
Well, they don't talk about it. Sound like...
They don't talk about it, but they I know that it's there. I get it from fans all the time. Like, what happened to your accent? Sorry, I've been here for like the majority of my adult life. Like,
you still sound very British to the rest of us.
I think
that don't live in the UK.
Well, and Donovan's probably going to end up with the same accent. You know,
oh, for you them. Think?
Well, because he's. But when you're a kid, you know, you just repeat what you hear. So he's going to. So I know I still say certain things with a British accent, but then there are certain things I say with an American accent. I know they have like an American inflection because I've been here so long. It's you just get used to the ebb and flow of conversation. And as you can tell, I'm a very conversation oriented person.
I love
I'm very vocal. You know what I mean? I'm like my very verbal, you know, in my energy. So it's like.
Has he started school yet?
No.
Because that's where he'll.
He did. So he was in pre-K. He's a September birthday.
Okay.
So
he'll be the oldest kid.
So we it was kind of one of those things where we went, do we want him to be the youngest in his class or the oldest? And we said, let's have him be the oldest. And it also meant that for a year, it's like he still goes to different daycare stuff and things to, you know, to help sort of nurture him and, you know, obviously keep him stimulated and make sure he's up to date on stuff. And I do a lot with him. Like we do ABC Mouse and he has his like phonics books and stuff with him today. But we just decided like, for a year, let's let him sort of just be around the stuff like this and, you know, like get some, you know, cool life experiences that you can't, because once he's in school, it's like, he's going to be in school, you know? And so we just sort of made that decision that let's kind of hippie it for a year.
He might have like a Tennessee accent if he's going to school in Tennessee.
I don't know. Who the hell knows?
Is there someone that you'd like you to challenge for this belt? Is there someone that you would can't wait to have a match with?
There are several, honestly. I mean, I know that I've said this before. I've always felt like, to me, like the ultimate sort of culmination of this journey and you know, given this sort of historical context of all of it and stuff, would be Triple H.
Sure. Wow.
At Starrcade. You know what I mean? Like, here's a guy who clearly, especially if you go back and look at his stuff in the early 2000s, clearly was trying to replicate the feel,
yeah,
and the presence and the aura of Harley Race and Ric Flair and, you know, Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe and guys like that. And he achieved it very well for a while. You know, he's reinvented himself several times. He's had different incarnations of his persona. But that period, it was like, you could tell he was like, this is what I wanted to be my whole life. He wanted, you know, and he had Flair with him, you know,
yeah,
and it's like
evolution. Yeah.
And so, I've heard through the grapevine that he has a replica of the 10 pounds of gold in a case in his office. I don't know if that's true or not. I've heard that. And it's like, clearly he holds holds this in high esteem. And, you know, and again, I know that it might seem that there's this sort of weird, like, bitterness or energy between, you know, negativity with me and WWE. I have nothing but love for those guys, right? Like, they and they have been very good to us, actually. Like, they're, you know, there's quite a steady communication between the NWA and WWE.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, about various different things, and it's like, and it's very kind of positive. And again, like I say, like when I, if I go to stuff, you know, with Mickey or whatever, it's like everybody there is cool, everyone's watching the stuff, you know, like, I mean, man, like, just you know when things are going good when guys who like Edge are happy to say it publicly. You know what I mean? Because he's said some very nice things to me privately, but publicly he's endorsed the show. So it's kind of like, that means that he's not only enjoying the show enough that he wants to help think, but it's also that he feels that the opinion is safe enough where people aren't going to go, that bullshit is terrible. You know what
right,
I mean? Like, he's
right.
Not, you know, and like, that's a, you know, that's a real thing. And I know that I'm not suggesting that he really cares that much about like getting, you know, trolled or whatever, but it's like, but I understand the mentality of it. It's like, it's kind of, if he kind of knew if he puts the NWO, he's not going to get any blowback for that.
Yeah.
You know? So, and like that, and that's where we know we've hit the sweet spot. I always joke that I'm the only person who's been able to unite the opinions of Jim Cornette, Vince Russo, Eric Bischoff, you know, because like, they all philosophically like completely disagree. Meltzer, you know, Wade Keller, like, but they all like the show. They all, and they, you know, and they're all digging what I'm doing. So it's,
yeah,
like, that's, you know, again, you take everyone's opinion with a pinch of salt, but if, you know, if you're able to unite all these different schools of thought, then that's what we're looking to do.
I really wonder if this match with Triple H could happen.
Why couldn't it?
Only it. The only reason
people didn't think me and Cody could happen because, oh, Cody's in Ring of Honor. Oh, what? Oh, what? He's like, well, that doesn't work, you know. Like, me and Marty, they were like, well, how is that going to work? You know, like, of course it can happen.
I think the only reason it couldn't happen is because WWE doesn't have these kinds of agreements with other companies. That's the only reason.
The thing is, it doesn't really need to be. It's not like they have to work out some sort of long-term, huge sort of set-in-stone agreement. It's just, let's make a prize fight. You know what I mean?
Would it happen here in NWA, or would it happen in WWE?
For me, I always envisioned that it would be Starrcade. If we were going to, you know, they own Starrcade, they own the IP or whatever, and it's like, you know, I've seen the last couple and kind of thought, that ain't Starrcade. Yeah?
Not without
like,
this.
Right. It's what makes this how is this Starrcade?
Well, it's just the,
you know,
name of another pay-per-view.
Right, how is this? But it's not even a pay-per-view. They didn't even do a pay-per-view last time. And I said, like, how is this Starrcade? You know, like, I mean, and again, I'm not, you know, whatever, right? Like, they're free to do whatever they want with it. But it's like, do you not think there's an opportunity there to make it really cool and special?
Yeah.
you know, I don't know.
Well, we're putting it out into the ether now.
I've said it before.
It's out into the world.
Yeah.
Well, it's out.
It's probably having the opposite effect, but who cares?
I should have pointed this out at the start of the interview, but look, I'm a normal-sized human, and look how...
You're getting there.
Thank you. I've worked out a few times before. But look at the size of, like, you're just so significantly wider than me. Yes.
I like, you know, one of the funny things that I've seen a lot of feedback recently, and again, I think it's just based on what the majority of the sort of fare is in wrestling now, as far as sort of performers, is like a lot of people just, they see that, they like the fact that, like, hey, you're just like a, he's like big and meaty guy.
You are. Because you have a very different build than you had when you were in TNA.
Sure.
And
sure.
this is the old school.
A wrestler.
Yeah.
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 Right.
If you told me, if I watched a clip of your match and said, oh, that was from 1983, I'd go, oh, yeah.
Right. And it's like, don't get me wrong, I love bodybuilding and I love lifting weights. And I like, but at the same time, I'm also at a point in my life where I'm kind of going, I don't care if I have abs. Like, you know what I mean? If they're there, great. If they're not, great. Like,
is that
whatever.
For like, you'd rather eat?
I'd rather enjoy my life. And, you know, enjoy things in moderation and just be, you know, and like don't get me wrong, every now and then I might kind of go a little soft, you know, we might have to tighten things up for a few weeks.
Right.
But I've been through phases with TNA, you know, I went through phases where I would be like, okay, I'm going to get really ripped, you know, and then I would get really ripped and lean. And then I would look, and it didn't come across on TV, you know, it's like, because big works better on TV, right? Yeah, I just wanted to have sort of, all I want is like some, you know, full, I like fullness is the best way to describe it. Like good, like fullness, like rounded musculature, right?
What do you weigh as you sit here right
250.
Now? 250. Oh my God. And what size suit is this?
It's custom made, man. Especially tailored for Nick H. Aldis. There you go.
That's embroidered on the inside. Yeah. All my suits are custom too, but I put ridiculous phrases on the inside.
Didn't we try to do something in Miami?
Yes.
Yeah. That's where I was living. So Miami, that's actually the guy. There's a guy in Miami, Nazir. He's making my stuff now. I'll show you the jacket downstairs.
Please.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, he reached out to me based on he'd seen the show, and was like, I have a red suit, like a red sort of plaid suit, and I rocked it one day on one of the episodes of Power, and he messaged me on Instagram and was like, this is a killer look. He's like, I'm a tailor, like we have this same fabric actually, like that's what caught my eye and blah blah. Oh, wow. Blah. And then he was like, I want to make, you know, I'd love to make you a suit, like, and I sent him all my measurements, and like I took some pictures just wearing like a loose fitting shirt and everything, like at his request. I mean, this suit came, and I kept thinking to myself, how good is it really going to be, like, having not met this guy in person? And I swear to God, this thing just, like, fell on, you know what I mean? It just was like, phew, magic, you know, and I just went, wow, like, and he's fantastic.
I could never go back to a suit off the rack now. Custom suits.
Can't do it.
They completely change everything.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for making the time to do this.
Oh, no, thank you.
I think we've been talking about this for exactly 1 year.
Yeah, yeah.
I interviewed Mickey at the Royal Rumble
last year. That's right, that's right. And then she texted me and said, hey, Chris Van Vliet wants to... I said, great, cool, yeah. Like, because I'd seen that you were starting to build some momentum and get some, you know, and building some great numbers. And I was like, cool, that would be great. You know, like, that would really help us out, you know, because I'd been doing, like, Sam Roberts and... Busted Open have been great to us, and all, yeah. You know, a few other good sort of big players in the wrestling media. And I was like, this guy's getting hot. Like, that'd be great. And then we just kept sort of missing each other and not being able to make.
Yeah,
it happen.
Was just like we were never in the same place at the same time to make it happen. Except when I saw you in New York, I'm like, okay, we're gonna make this happen.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because that was like 2 months ago. I saw you at the big event, and I'm
I had to in and out.
Yeah, you were walking by. You're like, we're gonna do an interview sometime. I'm like, I know we are.
I had to, see. I had Donovan with me that day because I had been in England. I had to, and that's why he was with me, because we'd been in England. And just the way that it had worked, I basically that kind of booked kind of last minute, and so I already had these other travel plans. So I went, okay, I can do it, but you'll have to. I'll have to come straight from England and I'll have to have Donovan with me. And then, and ideally I'd like to fly out that night, you know, so I can get home, cause I've been gone for like 2 weeks at that point.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, that's why he was with me.
The line that you had though for photos and autographs was huge. And
I
imagine that ever since Power started, you've started to see that ramp up.
There was the metrics are quite obvious. Yeah. Like you know, I used to notice how long Marty's line was, mm-hmm. you know, at different stuff, right? And I would think, like, man, that's really impressive. Like, you know, but mine would be okay, you know, it'd be the same as everyone else's, like, you know, a few deep. And then at the big event, it was like, me and Marty had the longest lines, you know, it was like, yes, cool. You know what I mean? Yeah. I signed solid for 3 hours solid. I didn't, no stops. Yeah.
Before we wrap it up, can I hold this?
Absolutely.
What? Oh my goodness. That feels like it weighs about 10 pounds.
I think it's more than 10 pounds. I think maybe the metal is 10 pounds, you know, and then the leather adds some more, but
this is incredible.
I'll tell you what. From day one with
and
the
this
NWA.
Is my country, so great.
I know we need a UK plate on there. The you know, I had the TNA World Championship, you know, and obviously, like, when I would go back to England, like, my niece and nephew and stuff would be like, oh, cool, the belt, you know, whatever. But this one is the only belt I've ever had that adults are like, do you have the belt with you? Can I, you know, like guys in the dressing room,
of
you know
course.
What I mean? Like, can I, you know, like, because it's an iconic thing. Like, that's an asset. Like, we joke about, like, that's the asset. Like, it's one of the main assets of the company.
And somehow I'm holding it right now. Well, so I will give it back to your very safe and capable hands. And I just want to thank you so much for your time.
Hey, no, thank you, man.
I appreciate you. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing. It's been such amazing. So amazing to watch this grow.
We're just getting started.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Oh, man. What a chat with the national treasure. Thank you so much for checking this out. Thank you for listening all the way until the end. Take a screenshot. Tag me. Tag Nick Aldis on Instagram or Twitter. I love reposting those. I love retweeting those, sharing those. I'm at Chris Van Vliet. And this interview with Nick is one of 7 interviews that I did in Atlanta last weekend. Follow me on Instagram at Chris Van Vliet so you can make sure to find out who those other interviews are with. I always post little teasers or I just flat out say, hey, my next interview is with so-and-so. So make sure you're following me on Instagram to find out about that. I loved his story about meeting Mickey James. And I think that we all know the person he's referring to when he says someone with a lot of power in WWE doesn't want him there. Winston Churchill said, we make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. Love that quote. So, you know, Thursday is my regular podcast day. So this is like, a little bonus. We're not calling it a bonus episode, but I have so many interviews that if I just put out one a week, we would be deep into 2021 releasing some of these ones. I mean, as the year goes on. So yes, Thursday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern time, whatever time that happens to be in the time zone that you live in. I guess that's 5 o'clock if you're on the West Coast. That's the middle of the day if you live in the UK. And well, that's almost bedtime if you live in Australia or New Zealand. But 8 a.m. Eastern time, that's when my new interviews drop every single Thursday. Make sure you subscribe for those ones. We will see you on Thursday.